listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. In the eighth year of fighting with terrorists in Syria, we bring you today this very interesting interview of Syria's President Bashar al-Assad, brought to us from Press TV's Damascus Bureau Chief, Hossan Murtada.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Mr. President, there are many issues which we will talk about, but in the light of the victories you have achieved, the main focus remains the south of Syria. What's happening exactly, or what is the nature of what is happening in the south of Syria?
To put it simply, after the liberation of Al-Ghouta, it was suggested that we should move south. We were faced with two options, as in the case in all other areas in Syria, reconciliation or liberation by force. At this point, the Russians suggested the possibility of giving reconciliation an opportunity, similar to what happened in other areas, in order to restore the situation that prevailed before 2011. In other words, for the Syrian army to be deployed in that area, which is an area of confrontation with the Zionist enemy. And of course, the terrorists should leave the area. This proposition suits us. Up till now, there are no concrete results for a simple reason, which is Israeli and American interference. For they put pressure on the terrorists in that area in order to prevent reaching any compromise or peaceful resolution. That is how the situation stands now.
So it's not been decided whether to move toward a military operation or toward reconciliation.
No. Contacts are still ongoing between the Russians, the Americans, and the Israelis, while nobody is communicating with the terrorists, because they are mere tools, and they implement what their masters decide ultimately. This is what happened. There was an opportunity to reach reconciliation, but the American and Israeli interference prevented that possibility.
Of course, this is the reality there. But on the other hand, there are those who talk about many things taking place in the South. Mr. President, is there a certain deal? What is the price? Is there really a price for concluding this deal in the South? Let me talk frankly about the issue of getting the Iranians to leave the southern region in return for Al-Tanf, for example. What did the Americans demand? Or let's say, what was the price the Americans asked to approve the reconciliation process in the South?
For the Americans, there is a general principle they follow in dealing with any problem in the world. The only price they ask for is absolute hegemony, regardless of the issue and the place. Of course, we shall never provide that price. Otherwise, we wouldn't have fought this war for years. We have been fighting for the independence of Syrian decision-making, for the Syrian homeland, and for the unity of Syrian territory. As for Iran in particular, let me be very clear. The Syrian-Iranian relationship is a strategic one, not subject to a deal in the south or in the north. This relationship, in terms of its implications and results on the ground, is linked to the present and future of the region. Consequently, it is not subject to the price tags of the international bazaar. Neither Syria nor Iran has floated this relationship on the international political bazaar for it to be subject to haggling. The proposition was made by the Israelis with the objective of provoking and embarrassing Iran. At the same time, this comes in line with the international propaganda campaign launched against Iran regarding the nuclear file. It is not a separate issue, for everything happening now is linked to Iran in order to create an international position against it. As for us in Syria, the decision concerning our land is an exclusively Syrian decision. We are fighting the same battle, and when we have a decision concerning Iran, we will talk about it with the Iranians and not with any other party.
Of course, we will talk about Iran and in more detail. But since we are talking about the Southern Front, let's explore it further. Practically in the same context, there is the MOC, which hasn't stopped its operation since the beginning of the war on Syria about 8 years ago. It is working and is still active and is directly linked to the Israelis. But we have noticed recently that it has been reactivated and there are more communications. Mr. President, does this mean that the Syrian state is practically moving toward a military decisive action in the south, regardless of the consequences, whether things reach a stalemate or not? Is there a decisive action in the cards for the Syrian leadership?
No. Mock has nothing to do with this decision. Mock has been linked to the presence and the role of the terrorists since the beginning of the war on Syria. That's why it existed, in order to lead them militarily. Consequently, the continued existence of this operations room means the continuation of the role given to these terrorists. They are equipped and prepared to carry out more terrorist acts. MOC is linked to the terrorists and not to the role of the Syrian state. Our role has nothing to do with it. Our decision has been clear from the beginning. We will liberate all Syrian lands. As to when to move south, north, east, or west, this is purely military issue. But regardless of MOC, we have moved towards the south and we are giving the political process a chance. If that doesn't succeed, we have no other option but to liberate it by force.
But there's a confrontation in the south, and the issue is not limited geographically to Syria in the larger political sense. There are the Americans, the Russians, the Iranians, the Israelis, and Hezbollah. All these parties are there in the area. What does that mean? How are you going to deal with this?
You are talking about two axes. One supporting terrorism and represented by the US, Israel, and some flunkies in the region, including some Arab and non-Arab states, and an anti-terrorist axis. The first axis supports terrorism and seeks hegemony, while the second axis seeks independence. So, there can be only one result for this confrontation, the victory of one of these axes. At least, as far as the anti-terrorist axis is concerned, it will not give up the process of cleaning Syria and the region of terrorism, and will not give up on the unity of Syrian territory. As to the other axis, will it change as a result of the reality on the ground? Let's wait and see. But in terms of substance and convictions, it will not change. While in terms of the political practices dictated by reality and the facts on the ground, it might.
Will the Americans leave Al-Tanf?
The Americans say they are ready, but everyone knows that the Americans are historically professional liars in politics. So why should we believe them? Also, we have to wait and see.
Mr. President, what's happening now in Jordan? Is it linked to what's happening on the southern front in particular? That is it linked to what's being plotted in that region, in your view?
In fact, the only information we have is what we hear in the media. In any case, we wish Jordan stability, not chaos, because the latter will have a negative impact on us.
Since we are talking about the South, let's close this file. Mr. President, what would make the Israeli occupation agree to the return of the Syrian army to the borders? That is, a return to the situation which existed at the beginning of 2011, after 7 years of repeated Zionist attempts directly and indirectly to undermine the Syrian state, the regime in Syria, and stability in Syria. Why would it agree now to the return of the Syrian army to the borders and to the occupied Golan?
Certainly, neither conviction, morality, nor international law means anything to the Israelis. Since the beginning of the war, particularly when it started to have a clear military nature on the southern front in particular, the Israelis used to shell Syrian forces continuously and consequently provide direct support to the terrorists. Israeli artillery and aircraft are the terrorists' artillery and aircraft. That applies to Jabhat al-Nusra, of course. Nothing is going to change this Israeli approach. As far as we are concerned, Israel's approval had no role at all. Despite Israeli support to the terrorists, we have been doing our job, and the Syrian army is fighting its way towards the southern front and has liberated a number of areas within the limits of its capabilities. So, with or without its approval, the decision is a Syrian one, and this is a national duty we shall carry out.
So a return of the Syrian army is better than having resistance in the Golan, for instance?
For the Israelis?
Yes.
I think the two options are bad for the Israelis. Both of them are bad. Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah has repeatedly talked about Syria's relationship with the resistance and a Syrian role in the resistance. So, how would the Israelis choose between two bad things for them?
As you said, Mr. President, Israel has financed, supported, and more dangerously been capable of enlisting a large number of Syrians, some of whom were treated inside occupied Palestine. They talked about it. In the future, how would you deal with this large number of Israeli agents? Maybe some of them were deceived, and Israel might have exploited the financial and living conditions of some others. And some have chosen to side with the Israelis. How would you deal with them in the future?
This is true. We cannot put everyone in the same basket. There are different reasons for moving in this wrong direction. And these people have wronged the homeland and every Syrian citizen. Ultimately, they are the children of this homeland, and we all bear responsibility for this problem, not only those who have done wrong. When crime, for instance, becomes widespread in a certain country, the whole society bears responsibility for this crime, not only the security agencies or the criminals themselves. The first thing that should be done is to accommodate these people. Second, we need to address the root causes which led to this case of weak patriotism. The causes here are many and complicated, and the scope of this interview doesn't allow for all of them to be mentioned.
In the same context, while you're talking about restoring the Syrian air defense systems and confronting the Zionist occupation, statements have been made by leaders of the Israeli entity that they will strike at the depth of the Syrian territory. How would you deal with that situation, particularly that balance has been achieved recently, that is, balance between the Israeli aggressions and the Syrian responses?
Basically, we haven't stopped responding. First of all, we haven't stopped fighting terrorists. And at the same time, we haven't stopped responding to Israeli aggression within the capabilities available to us, militarily and technically. Moreover, the more these capabilities improve, the response will be better and higher. But in fact, the strongest response to Israel now is to strike the Israeli army existing in Syria, which consists practically of the terrorists.
Full formations.
Of course, for they are acting clearly and starkly in Israel's interest. The first acts they carried out were attacks against the air defense systems. What is the link between air defense systems and the terrorists acting as infantry on the ground? This was an Israeli order. It was an Israeli-American order because it is the same thing. So, they are Israel's army inside Syria. And the first strike against Israel, politically, militarily, and in every other area, is to strike Israel's terrorists inside Syria. Whether they belong to ISIS, Al-Nusra, or the other groups linked to the Israeli plan and strategy.
And you invited Iranian advisors to come?
This is what's happening. It's escalating, and we are responding. Ultimately, we are fighting the war within the capabilities available to us, and we are doing our best within these capabilities. A response does not need a political decision. I stress that responding or not responding is not a political decision. It is a national decision, and it was taken from day one. But implementing this decision depends on what we can do militarily and not politically.
In terms of capabilities, there's one issue in the media which we are always following. That is the S-300 Russian missiles. Russia says we will deliver these missiles and then says we will not deliver them, which means that the issue is not clear. What is happening exactly? Why is Russia hesitating, in your view, to deliver the S-300 missiles to Syria while some other countries have been seeking S-400? Does this mean they are ahead of us in this regard?
You know that military action and military considerations are part of political considerations. Consequently, a statement, even if it is of a military nature, carries at the same time political messages. So, why did the Russians say that they want to send or not send? This is a statement that the Russians should be asked about because it might be part of their political tactics. As to the military aspect of the statement, which concerns Syria, it's not our custom to talk about the weapon which we will be delivered or not delivered. The evidence was that the weapons used in response to the last two aggressions, the tripartite aggression, and after that the Israeli aggression, were not announced by Syria. We traditionally do not announce cases of technical military nature.
So even the nature of the response is not linked to the issue of the S-300 missiles?
No, the same applies. Even if the S-300 missiles will be provided or not provided, we will not say that they were delivered to Syria. A weapon is used when it must be used.
Is there a possibility that you've developed certain weapons?
This remains a possibility. In any case, the result is the same. Weapons shouldn't be talked about until they are used. Weapons announce themselves only when they are used.
Mr. President, let's return to the political aspect, since we are talking about the Southern Front. Regarding the general situation, in light of all that has been achieved in Syria today, the most prominent actor is the Tripartite Alliance, or what is being called the Tripartite Alliance. I mean Syria, Iran, and Russia. What is the nature of this alliance? Is it a temporary alliance in the sense that it is linked to fighting terrorism or certain developments on the Syrian perspective? Recently, we have started to see, or let's say some have focused on certain points in order to show a certain fracture in this alliance. What is your take on that, and what is the actual reality of this alliance?
If we talk first about the Syrian-Iranian part, for 40 years and in the different conditions that the Middle East region has gone through, this alliance remained solid. So, there is no reason to say that it is temporary or otherwise. The new element in the war on Syria is the Russian element, and that's why this tripartite alliance came into existence. Our relationship with Russia is now about 7 decades old. Despite the fluctuations and the fall of the Soviet Union, the rule of President Yeltsin, and the deterioration of these relations to a large degree for us, it has never reached the stage of reversing this relationship with Syria. Russia continued to deal with Syria as a friendly state. and we have imported everything from Russia, including weapons, during the different stages of the sanctions imposed on Syria. It is not in the nature of the Russians to build temporary or self-serving alliances or to sell out on relations in order to get deals done. The relationship is definitely a strategic one, but the political statements allowed for these speculations. These statements also aim at sending messages in different directions. Maybe sometimes the language or the choice of particular terminology might not be helpful and might take the statement in a different direction at odds with the content of the statement. This happens from time to time. However, these statements shouldn't be taken out of context. The Russian view of the relationship with Iran is a strategic one. As for Syria, the Russians do not interfere in Syrian affairs. If they have a certain opinion, they raise it with us and say that. In the end, the decision is that of the Syrian leadership and the Syrian people. This is a constant principle for Russia. Therefore, the alliance is a strategic one. And if there are differences, such differences happen within the Syrian state. And you see differences within the Iranian state and within the Russian state. It is natural for us to differ on daily tactical details. For why conduct a dialogue if we agree on everything? We meet extensively in order to reach agreement.
So this tripartite alliance is being consolidated?
Of course. This is dictated by reality, interest, and international changes that make it necessary for this alliance to be consolidated. As long as the other axis supports terrorism, and as long as we, together with Iran and Russia, feel the danger of terrorism, not only in Syria but also on all these countries and on the whole world, and as long as Syria, Iran, and Russia realize the importance of abiding by international law, these facts make the existence of this alliance necessary.
But there are those who say that Syria will get a price if the Iranians leave Syrian territories. Is there a certain political, moral, or military price in this regard?
As I said in the beginning, as long as this relationship is not floated in the bazaar, they cannot offer a price, and the answer will be clear. That's why they don't dare suggest this price. This issue was raised by different countries, including Saudi Arabia, for instance, at the beginning of the war. And not only at the beginning, but at different stages. The proposition was that if Syria cut its relationship with Iran, the situation in Syria will be normal. This principle is basically rejected by us.
So there were initiatives, so to speak, made in this regard by Saudi Arabia.
During the war?
Yes.
Of course, more than once, and in a clear manner.
Directly?
Directly. The relationship with Iran was the basis for every proposition. And Saudi Arabia's position on this subject is public. I am not revealing a secret.
An issue has been raised in Syria, Iran, or Lebanon about the nature of the Iranian presence in Syria. Some call them Iranian advisors. Even the Syrian foreign minister used the same term. At the same time, we notice that there are Iranian martyrs. Frankly, Mr. President, what is the nature of the Iranian presence in Syria now?
The term advisor is sometimes used in a broad manner. These advisors have been with us through the long-standing relationship with Iran, even before the war, because the military relationship is close. When a military formation moves to a fighting position, the advisor becomes a fighter. So, the word can be used in different senses. There are certainly Iranian advisors in Syria, and there are groups of Iranian volunteers who came to Syria, and they are led by Iranian officers. Iran has fought with and defended the Syrian people. It offered blood. That's why when we say advisors, this is a generic term. But this doesn't mean that we are ashamed of any Iranian presence, even if it is official. But we use the word advisors because there are no regular Iranian fighting units in Syria.
Full formations.
Exactly. There are no battalions or brigades or divisions. First, we can't hide them. And then, why should we be ashamed of that? When we invited the Russians legally to come to Syria, we were not ashamed of that. And if there were an Iranian formation, we would announce it. Because such relations need agreements between the two states endorsed by parliaments. Such relations cannot be concealed.
And you invited Iranian advisors to come?
Of course. From the beginning, we invited the Iranians, and then we invited the Russians. We needed the support of these countries, and they answered the call.
Mr. President, you said more than once that there are no Iranian bases in Syria.
That's correct.
So how come there are no Iranian bases while we notice that there are a number of Russian ones?
There is nothing that prevents the existence of such bases, as long as Iran is an ally, as is Russia. If we ask, we will ask them to agree. I mean, that we could ask for the existence of such forces to support us. Iran has never asked and does not have an interest except in fighting terrorism. But the evolution of the war made it necessary to develop the nature of this presence. This happened as far as the Russians are concerned. In the beginning, Russian support, like Iranian support, was different from what it is today. The support for terrorism has developed internationally and globally when the Syrian army confronted those terrorists. And with that, Russian and Iranian military presence developed. At a certain stage, we found, with the Russians of course, that the existence of air bases was necessary to provide air support to the Syrian army. And now, if we find, in cooperation, coordination, or dialogue with the Iranians, that there is a need for Iranian military bases, we will not hesitate. But now, Iranian support in its present form is good and effective.
Why haven't you visited Iran so far, although you visited Russia more than once?
That's correct. In fact, there was a scheduled visit to Iran a few months ago, and it was postponed and not cancelled. It was postponed because of an emergency in Syria related to the development of battles. There is certainly no reason which prevents such a visit, and I'll visit Iran hopefully soon on the earliest opportunity. This is natural, but the issue is logistic, no more, no less.
Mr. President, I move to another file. Last week, it was the Jerusalem International Day, and the Palestinian cause is going through its most difficult stages. We are talking about the deal of the century and moving the American embassy to occupy Jerusalem. What do you have to say about Palestine? Is Syria still capable of supporting the Palestine cause? Basically, wasn't one of the most important objectives of the war on Syria to get Syria out of the axis of resistance and to prevent it from supporting resistance, whether in Lebanon or Palestine?
The Palestine context, since 1948 up till now, has been a complicated one because the regional context is complicated. Of course, it is complicated because the colonial West, which is particularly supportive of Israel, has always created elements which aim at one single thing. First, to drive to desperation the Arab citizen, who is historically attached to the cause of Palestine and who has always considered it a pan-Arab cause that touched him even on the national level. The other objective has been to distract the Arab peoples together with states or societies in general to marginal causes so that they do not have time to think about Israel. And they have succeeded to a great extent, most recently through the so-called Arab Spring, which has aimed at destroying the political, military, and psychological infrastructure of Arab societies. Nevertheless, recent developments have proven that the Arab people is still conscientiously attached to the cause of Palestine. As for Syria, since it has been part of these plots to undermine the Arab condition in general, first, for Syria to support the cause of Palestine, it should first of all destroy the Israeli army in Syria. Restoring stability in Syria, striking terrorism, and foiling the Israeli plot in Syria is certainly part of supporting the cause of Palestine. The support might be indirect with direct consequences, but these direct consequences are linked to the internal Palestinian condition. We shouldn't forget that the Palestinians are divided between groups which resist Israel and are genuinely linked to the cause of Palestine, and other groups which are against the resistance and support surrenderist and defeatist peace, while there are other groups which use resistance as a title in order to achieve their political objectives under the slogan of religion. This is, of course, the Muslim Brotherhood's approach.
Are you prepared to offer whatever the resistance asks of you, whether in the form of political, military, or any other form of support?
Politically, we haven't changed. The Palestinian question for us is still as it was 10 years ago and decades ago. It hasn't changed. As to what we can offer, this has to do with two things. First, Syria's current capabilities, and there is no doubt that the priority is given now to cleaning Syria of terrorism. Second, it has to do with the Palestinian condition and the parties with which we can deal within the Palestinian arena.
Since we are talking about resistance, there's the other side. In addition to some countries which stood beside Syria in fighting terrorism, there was also a role played by the resistance in Lebanon, particularly Hezbollah, which provided a great deal and contributed to fighting terrorism. What do you say, Mr. President, to resistance fighters and families of martyrs and the wounded?
When all these groups of resistance get together to defend Syrian soil and Syrian citizens, including the Lebanese resistance and the brothers who came from Iraq, some of whom reproached me for not mentioning them by name, I take this opportunity to stress that there are brothers from Iraq to whom we give the same weight of any resistance fighter who came from any other country. There are also the families of resistance fighters who came from Iran and sacrificed their blood in Syria. We should put all these in the same basket next to the Syrian martyrs, fighters, and their families. To those I say that all the letters, the words, the sentences, and the whole of literature are much less than a single drop of blood. Therefore, words are of a much lesser value than what they have offered. What's more important is what history will write about them. In fact, when we talk about writing history, we need to highlight that history needs a strategy and needs X. But the fact remains that strategy without implementation on the ground has no value. It remains mere thought, which we might include in books and essays. But the reality is that these individuals in these countries, this group of resistance fighters, not politics, write history. I would like to use the answer to this question to express to them all my love, respect, and appreciation, and my reverence to the fighters, the wounded, and martyrs, and to all their families who are courage incarnated and who send these individuals to Syria to defend it and fight terrorism, so that these families become models of morality and principles for present and future generations.
Have you asked Hezbollah to leave Syria? A few days ago, His Eminence Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah talked about this issue and said that nobody can get us out of Syria unless the Syrian leadership asks us to do so.
The battle is long and ongoing. When we talk about this tripartite alliance, and if we consider it a quadruple alliance when we add Hezbollah, we talk about the tripartite alliance in terms of the states included. But in the end, Hezbollah is a basic element in this war. The battle is long, and the need for these military forces will continue for a long time. When there is a need, and when Hezbollah, Iran, or others believe that terrorism has been eliminated, they will tell us that they want to go home. As Sayyid Hassan said, they have families and daily interests, which is normal, but it is still early to talk about this subject.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. The Trump juggernaut continues on all fronts. Is he remaking the Western world or merely isolating the U.S.? Also, is North Korea coming out of the cold? And much, much more on this edition of Crosstalk. Crosstalking an unstable world, I'm joined by my guest, Mark Sloboda. He's an international affairs and security analyst. We also have Dmitry Bobich. He is a political analyst with Sputnik International. And in Plymouth, we cross to Patrick Henningsen. He is a journalist, writer, and founder of the news website 21stCenturyWire.com. All right, gentlemen, Crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Patrick, let me go to you first in Plymouth. So much to chew on here. Reflect upon my introduction. Is Trump trying to recast the Western world and maybe the whole world in its entirety, or is this really just isolating the United States, or a combination of all of what I've just said? Go ahead, Patrick, in Plymouth.
Yeah, this is the big challenge to determine, firstly, what is U.S. foreign policy? I think there's a tendency by academics and by some commentators to try to look for breaking trends, to try to generalize everything into sort of larger themes like is this a revival of a realist foreign policy, or is this a continuation or a different version of a liberal globalization-based foreign policy? I think it's really difficult because if you look at history, the only consistency with a lot of U.S. foreign policy is its inconsistency. Mm. So you see hypocrisy at every turn, no matter how many administrations you go back to. But one thing that is consistent is a kind of post-World War II grand strategy. And so the United States, as it's come out of the Cold War period, then entered a kind of period where full spectrum dominance was its main priority. And I think to some degree, that is still where a lot of Washington's thinking is directed, Pentagon-led full spectrum dominance, as Thomas Barnett sort of, laid out during the Bush administration. But in terms of Donald Trump, I think the United States is at a very interesting crossroads because this is the first time where it's not expanding in 120 years internationally. It's actually having to reconsolidate its positions, not just at home, but abroad as well. And I think Donald Trump is the ideal Chapter 11 practitioner, maybe for this point in U.S. history.
Chapter 11, that's really great. Mark here. I mean, also, everybody's looking for these kind of short phrases to describe. I came across one, no friends, no enemies. That would at least work in the case of dealing with the, I guess we can use the correct term, disastrous G7 meeting in Canada. And no enemies are dealing with North Korea, at least for the time being, as some kind of partner, a legitimate partner. No friends, no enemies.
Yeah, I don't think that there is a coherent Trump foreign policy, and I don't think that should surprise us because it's quite clear that Trump doesn't have complete control of U.S. foreign policy. Congress has multiple times attempted to usurp that right, pushing him, passing legislation, forcing him to put new sanctions on Russia. Now they're putting forward a bill trying to forbid the president, the commander-in-chief, from withdrawing troops from South Korea without receiving the approval of the Secretary of Defense. That's fascinating.
We also have members of Congress petitioning the Pentagon not to sell jet fighters, the F-35s to Turkey
to a NATO ally. And they're also threatening against India. But the one thing that Congress doesn't seem to want to reclaim is their actual constitution-given power.
Yeah, they're very choosy. They really cherry-pick. Dima.
I agree with Peter that the big question is, are we seeing the continuation of the same so-called liberal or ultra-liberal world order being built, or are we seeing something else? Well, I think that Trump is actually less dangerous than the people who were building that so-called world order during the last 25 years. Because if we compare the world to an apartment block, what these people want is to demolish it completely, build a new one. Russia and China, as the biggest tenants right now, are voicing their objections, their doubts. The usual response is, just don't worry, you will be better off. We'll give you new apartments, right? And Trump is just, openly crushing the walls around himself, putting up new walls.
He is a real estate agent.
Absolutely. He did not go with the original plan. He is just simply expanding.
Patrick, let me go back to you and Plymouth, because I think what's really interesting here is that the United States still wants to lead. Okay, it still wants to be dominant, but it's not doing it with its allies because it sees its allies as being a dead weight. Okay, I mean they don't pay their own way; they get preferential trade deals. So this is what makes Trump a bit different. He still wants to win and be number one. He just doesn't really care. He doesn't want to carry the load for the entire Western world anymore because he doesn't see it as being cost effective. Again, he's a real estate agent. Patrick and Plymouth.
Sure. This is the transactional nature of this administration, that you see this reflected through through the White House. You see it especially through Nikki Haley, although she's taking her wrecking ball towards multilateral institutions like the United Nations and other sort of international institutions. And Donald Trump is sort of taking the wrecking ball maybe towards NATO, you could say, and in some ways the European Union. But I think you got two different sides of foreign policy here. You need to separate Europe and what's going in that hemisphere and all the legacy, post-World War II legacy there, with Asia. And Donald Trump is much more comfortable in Asia, and he's doing exactly the opposite of what the previous administration did, which was lead from behind. This is a president now that doesn't want to be upstaged by his Secretary of State. He's actually taking the lead. He's interfacing directly with some of the most powerful leaders in that region, and I think he's more comfortable in that environment. That's where the money is. This is where the future is. Asia is forward-looking. It's certainly on the cusp of the global economic surge in that part of the world. So this is definitely much more of a comfort zone for this president. But in Europe, it's much more problematic.
Patrick,
political issues.
Patrick,
as well.
I mean, I mentioned the G7. I mean, and this is kind of my mantra, my hobby horse here, is that Trump is not in tune with the postmodernist order of things, the postmodern mindset, and that's the G7. Okay, and particularly Europe. He doesn't see eye to eye with Macron, with Trudeau, with people like that. Because he just has a very different understanding of everyday politics. He's not a theoretician, okay? He doesn't have a theory. He's a practitioner. Let me go to Mark here on that.
Yeah, he's not a liberal. I mean,
he's not a liberal.
I think that summed it up. And Patrick, thank you. My brain is now imprinted with an image of Nikki Haley as Miley Cyrus driving a wrecking ball into the United Nations. Right?
Yes.
So. Here's the problem. Even it's a divide between not only the U.S. deep state and the Trump administration, but between Trump and people within his own administration, like Mad Dog Mattis and so on. They still want to pursue American hegemony, and there's no way America has given up on the pursuit of global military, financial, and other means of hegemony around the world. Trump does see that as wasteful. I've seen a characterization that he loathes the liberal international order that has been created, well, since the establishment of Bretton Woods through the unipolar moment and so on, because he does see it as not as damaging the U.S., as transferring wealth and the U.S. overplaying the role of defense when it doesn't need to around the world. He sees ostensible U.S. allies like the EU as rivals, as economic rivals, because he's a businessman, and that's the way that he views the world, on business terms. And he sees ins and outs at an imbalance, particularly with Europe. And he faults Europe as having worse trade policies for the U.S. than China. Jeffrey Goldberg in The Atlantic this week did it in an article. He's famous for giving this softball interview to Obama, an Obama apologist. Where Obama told him that his foreign policy was simply don't do stupid
stuff.
Yes, shall
Which
we
he
say.
Did.
Well, Jeffrey Goldberg got three different characterizations, supposedly from three different anonymous officials within the Trump administration, of how to define a Trump foreign policy. The first one was this no friends, no enemies, which is a very realist interpretation. Unfortunately, Trump, if he wanted to pursue that, I don't think he's had the ability to pursue that as much as he would like. One of the second ones, I think, will feed a lot of conspiracy theories that may not be conspiracy theories anymore, that permanent destabilization creates American advantage. Well, that sums up American foreign policy and military policy and what they've done in the Middle East, the support of terrorists, in Libya and Syria and so on. And the last one sums it up as far as the liberals are concerned. We're America, B-I-T-C-H.
Think of Breaking Bad, everybody. Thinking of Breaking Bad. Dima, but also you could say, kind of as a extra layer from what we've heard from Patrick and from Mark, is that Trump is determined to undo everything Barack Obama did. Okay, everything.
Well, in a strange way, yes. Interestingly, Trump, not understanding actually all the terrible things that Barack Obama did, suddenly summed it up wonderfully. You know, recently he said that it was thanks to Obama that Crimea became Russian. He obviously meant that Obama was weak or soft. No.
He looked
Obama
at it from the other way around, yes.
Supported sure. the coup in Ukraine, without which Crimea would never have gone back to Russia. People would never be pushed to vote for that at the referendum for going back to Russia. So just, unintentionally, Trump told the truth. And if we compare Trump and the so-called liberals in the U.S. administration, Trump is more peaceful. Let me give you
Let me just give you, all right, you got 20 seconds to explain that comment.
It's just the headline from The Nation. The media response to a meeting Kim Jong-un had with Trump betrays a cynical attitude to South Korea's security. Basically, the media response was Trump made concessions. He gave up on the exercises. He's betraying the United States.
All I would say in his defense, if I were to defend him, that's part of art of the deal. Gentlemen, I'm going to jump in here. We're going to go to a short break. And after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on some real news. Stay with RT.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Welcome back to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter LaBelle. To remind you, we're discussing some real news. Okay, gentlemen, let's change gears. Let me go back to Patrick in Plymouth. There's whispers and talk and rumors that we could possibly see a Trump-Putin summit one-on-one in Europe surrounding the annual meeting of the NATO alliance here. Should the two meet? Patrick, go.
Well, received logic would say no. That would be the equivalent of an apocalypse. For the resistance in the United States,
sure.
It could short-circuit CNN altogether, and there would be a mass trauma. They would need to deploy psychologists
Rachel Maddow will start being paid $500,000 per program. Okay, go ahead, keep going, Patrick.
I think spring the trap is the advice I would give to the president, because he's going off of a successful meeting with Kim Jong-un in Singapore. And with this president, there are no risks, really, internationally, because, anything he does is going to be attacked and put down by the opposition in the United States, but not by the international media. So maybe there's an opportunity for this president to maybe, in the way that Ronald Reagan jumped over the media to the domestic population in the 80s, that Trump could connect with a portion of the international community globally by doing positive things internationally. Certainly, there's no risk. There's a lot of rewards, however, in terms of legacy, in terms of the 2020 elections. So as the Russiagate burns out and fizzles out, people are going to be looking at results. They're going to be looking at deliverables, and certainly good relations with Asia and Russia is
something. That's a good point. Results, Mark. See, that's what I have in the back of my mind. Would there be any results other than a photo op?
No, there was, just like there wasn't really any results in North Korea other than a photo op. Mm-hmm. I mean, the real summits should take place after the details are hashed out by policy wonks, compromises are made, and then the principals are brought in to sign on. This is a photo op and political theater first. In a way, it's useful because it buys the U.S. off while North Korea and South Korea continue the real work of making a deal, of a peace deal and a denuclearization deal. What Trump signed with Kim Jong-un, it was not anywhere near a deal for denuclearization. In fact, former U.S. presidents have signed far more detailed deals, legal contracts for denuclearization with North Korea, and they've all come to naught. I mean, we have to think that, George Bush, the senior, signed a deal for denuclearization with North Korea that Bill Clinton ripped up. Mm-hmm. And then Bill Clinton signed a deal with
But let's be
Gaddafi.
Fair. I mean, it makes, I don't want to give the impression here this was all the North Koreans' fault. Yeah. Under the Bush senior, it was Congress that was unwilling to fund the deal. Okay, they pulled out from it, and then you have the axis of evil under Bush Jr. So they failed for multiple reasons, and there is evidence there was a lack of good faith also on the North Korean part. But let's make sure the blame is apportioned.
This was not a deal. This was an aspirational declaration. Look at the language.
The Singapore.
The Singapore.
Okay,
deal,
I agree.
Right? Promote. Work towards, right? These are not the language. This is deals.
Okay, I want to get back to Korea, but I want to ask Dima here. Should Putin and Trump meet?
Well, I think if they meet, the results will not be very impressive because I think the momentum has been lost.
Don't you think Trump wants to do it just to stick his thumb into the Democrats?
This is
why
Democrat. Putin shouldn't do it.
That's why.
Okay, exactly. Other than a PR opportunity for Trump, it's not going to be much more because Trump is already surrounded by the people like John Bolton, like Mike Pompeo. I just can't imagine any real result coming from such a summit. I think the time has been lost. You know, if Trump had met Putin in the beginning of 2017, right after he gave all these promises during his campaign, you know, that he would improve relations with Russia, well, he would face tremendous opposition from the CNN. CNN would be short-circuiting like every day, but there would be an opportunity to do something. Now I think time has been lost. It's too late.
I tend to would say to put it on check here. Now, Patrick, I want to go back to North Korea here. I mean, I think we all agree, and I think Mark put it perfectly, it's aspirational at this point. But there is something different here, is that Donald Trump, he's now, it's on him. It's his, okay? And he wants to win this, okay? And perception is everything in his mind here. That's why I tend to think this process has legs. Probably most importantly is if the U.S., meaning the people surround Donald Trump, let the Koreans do the hard work. And if they can do that and have some kind of breakthrough, something could come about. Though it's not going to be the 100% that the Pompeos and the Boltons want. But it will be what the Koreans want. And I think that Trump could agree to that. Go ahead, Patrick.
No, absolutely. And I'll agree with Mark on that point about letting South Korea and North Korea get on with the business of what they need to do. And certainly that's one of the things that will definitely come out of this. That's kind of an overarching theme. As soon as Donald Trump sort of canceled the meeting, then you see Kim off to Beijing. You see closer ties and communication between Pyongyang and Beijing. So as Asian powers can get together, they can have multilateral discussions without the United States mediating on it. And I think this is the theme you're going to see all around the world, as the United States is no longer perceived as a kind of honest broker for international disputes. So people are getting on with the business themselves. But what's really important is that in Asia, appearances mean everything. So this image of North and South Korea walking over the line, holding hands together, both presidents, Donald Trump saluting a North Korean general. You juxtapose that with Obama bowing to a Saudi king. This is a very different sort of bit of optics we're looking at here, but it means something to Asian people. That's what's important. And so they fully expect that Donald Trump will not renege on any movement forward on these deals. So it's a very different kind of expectation than you see in Europe. So Asia and Europe, two totally different cases in terms of how optics is perceived in the public.
Mark, I mean, we have this, and we could do a program every week on the impending trade war or the ongoing trade war. What is Trump signaling here? I mean, he is playing really hardball when it comes to these tariffs issues. Is the signal he's sending to everyone around the world is that he's serious? He's drawn a line in the sand, and we can work on these other things. But this is actually kind of a weird global confidence-building exercise that he's conducting right now, as much as it is unpleasant for America's trading partners.
Yeah, I mean, we've got headlines in here. We've got foreign policy. The West will die so that Trump can win, by Ben Steele.
We've got apocalyptic everything.
In the New York Times, Corey Shockey from the International Institute of Strategic Studies, the Trump doctrine is winning and the world is losing. All right, Trump, I think, really is trying to get out from underneath his handlers and rip the liberal international order up. He sees himself whether it's true or not, I don't think so, but he sees himself as this incredible deal maker, the art of the deal, and he sees the U.S. getting the, you know, the wrong end for decades now, and he wants to rip up and renegotiate deals. He wants to rip up NAFTA completely. Canada is actually the biggest target of his tariffs. Poor little Justin Trudeau is getting hit with $12 billion, right? The EU, another $8 billion. China, only $3 billion. But he's trying to rip this order up and renegotiate a deal that he sees would be in the U.S.'s favor. And this is why, you know, his turning away from this traditional U.S. allies, Canada, the EU, has got, you know, the deep state in the U.S. petrified. Even as he reaches out to some that have traditionally been, U.S. adversaries, we're thinking of North Korea, of China, of Russia, and said, well, I'm a businessman. We can do business. The transactional relationship.
Yeah, I mean, because
it's
transactional. It's not, again, the ideology. You know, Dima, the way Trump has been treating the Europeans, mm-hmm. it's kind of akin to, you know, parents having 40-year-old children still living at home. It's time to move on. Okay,
absolutely.
You've got an education. You're smart. You're wealthy now. You have to start taking care of.
And you're not spending anything on defense.
And you're not spending anything on upkeep of the house. Okay, at least the house you're living in. So it's time to move out and get on with your lives.
There was a very good argument in The Guardian, surprisingly, about Trump's treatment of NAFTA. That NAFTA is, the Canadians view NAFTA as if it is forever, you know. Mm. And Trump insists it should be expiring in 5 years, and then new terms should be negotiated.
That was by George Monbiot, nonetheless. Yes. Donald Trump was right. The rest of the G7 was wrong.
And that's in The Guardian. So something is really changing in the world right now. But I think Stephen Kotkin in the Foreign Affairs, he published an article called The Realist World, where he actually admits that most of the people in the United States, the so-called provincials, have been left out. You know, globalization has been enriching big companies, big urban centers. Well, Kotkin admits the fact that China had the same problem. You know, big Chinese companies were more eager to invest in Africa or in Latin America than in mainland China. So basically, he is not admitting the fact that this was all about greedy capitalism just destroying sometimes
its own countries. It was all about democracy, Dima.
Well, Marx made one mistake. Marx said that...
Just one mistake?
Workers have no motherland. I think workers have a motherland. Capital has no motherland. Capital just moves around.
Right. We agree on that.
Last word, Mark, before we go to the extended version.
The big thing is this. The pundits were furious with Donald Trump for sitting down. They were furious for some reason that the American flag was flown next to the North Korean flag. Trump is meeting with a brutal dictator. U.S. leaders meet with brutal dictators all the time. You don't have a problem with Obama and Hillary Clinton with Mohammed bin Salman and the Saudi flag. So what's the deal here? It's pure partisanship. Mm-hmm. It's political theater. The ones that were really denied in all of this were the South Koreans. They were treated like children in all of this. And the argument was, Trump is abrogating our security guarantees to South Korea. South Koreans don't want that. Moon Jae-in is in support of this meeting with Trump.
And he was generously rewarded in elections the day after.
81% of South Koreans supported this summit.
Okay.
88% supported the summit.
On that note, gentlemen, this is the end of our broadcast version. Many thanks to my guests here in Moscow and in Plymouth. Now for the extended version of our program where we have political potpourri. Okay, let me go back to Plymouth. Patrick, what's on your mind?
Well, I thought it's really important to point out the recent Inspector General report, which it seems to be what the White House has been looking for. And they can use this as either a battering ram or a shield. But it's certainly one of the first breaks, I think, that the Trump administration has got in the whole Russiagate fiasco. One thing is I would point out that let's not forget, who James Comey is, former FBI director. He's essentially he's been an elite fixer for most of his career. And so if you look at, you know, his tenure right through the government, then into HSBC, and then back into government again, he's always kind of been there in the shadows with the kind of invisible hand behind the Clinton syndicate, let's say. And so this is kind of interesting. Comey, McCabe, Rosenstein to a lesser degree. But this is kind of exposed an inherent corruption within the FBI. And I think this is a potential turning point in the Russiagate narrative, which has been losing steam for months now. So a little bit of an opportunity for momentum for this White House. So that's something to consider.
Well, let me get a mark on the IG report. I mean, from what I read of it, number one, if there was any real serious meddling in the 2016 election, it was at the upper echelons of the FBI. That seemed quite obvious to me. Also, it seems quite obvious to me is that they're sloppy and they're incompetent. I mean, it's scary when they're doing this, but their incompetence is what stands out, Mark.
Yeah, it's important to note that this Inspector General report is not about the Mueller investigation of Trump. It's about Hillary Clinton's email server scandal. And it identified actually, they're now the liberal media is even forced to admit that Trump actually had good reasons to fire Comey, that he did a lot of things wrong, that he violated a lot of procedures, and there was the report says there was the appearance of political bias. Oh, come on. Stop Trump, right? I mean, this is two FBI agents.
Let me tell you. When I saw the snippets of Christopher Wray, the head of the FBI now, I'll give this to Dima. It reminded me of Comey taking the presser saying, showing all the sins and mistakes that Hillary Clinton made, but no reasonable prosecutor would take the case. It was a flash from the past here. I mean, I found that truly extraordinary. They did it to us twice, okay, and different administrations.
Well, again, just like with Crimea, Trump is right for her own reason. I mean, and the reason why the Republicans love this report by Inspector General is because they feel like Comey let Hillary off the hook too easily, right? But actually, you know, this is the truth. This is the truth. And that Inspector General sort of unmasks the whole story behind this fight around Hillary Clinton. And I kind of agree with the conclusion that now no one will dispute the fact that the FBI played a role in 2016 election. That's a conclusion made by Peter Van Buren in American Conservative.
But it does have major implications because so many of the same figures.
Well, that's exactly what I was going to say. But Patrick, exactly right. Mark is exactly right. Because we're going to see the same faces and names all over again because they were involved in the Hillary cover-up and digging for dirt on Trump here. The same cast of characters. And Peter Strzok still works there. Amazing. Patrick.
So that brings us back to the original Nunes memo. Everything in there is factually correct. You know, Christopher Steele working ostensibly as an informant for the FBI, and he's the co-author or the coordinator of this dodgy dossier. So but back to the report. Maybe you can't prove forensically that there's any political bias in terms of partisan bias, but I think you can show that there is a different kind of bias, which is a deep state bias, and this is something that's not so difficult, so easy to put your finger on as maybe a Democrat or Republican bias, but there is a deep state bias, and there is people are coming to the realization that there are operators in the civil service there that transcend administrations and even overt political agendas, and there is a deep state, and it is controlling and it is doing damage to the democratic system. This whole Russiagate thing has done more damage to democracy in the same way that blaming Russia for Brexit does damage to democracy in Britain, because they're robbing the voters of their, they're disenfranchising people who went out and voted. They're basically saying, well, your vote meant nothing.
That's right, Patrick, that's right. Yeah. But, you know, their position is the people voted the wrong way, and this is their punishment. Dima, go ahead.
Well, I see the same pattern in the migration story, which is now rocking the German government. It looks like the government coalition is going to collapse.
It might not stand.
Well, I mean, they are just discussing details, like whether Germany Albania should turn back the refugees who had been registered in other EU member countries. No one is asking the question, why did the EU support all of these revolutions in Libya, in Egypt, in Syria, which produced these refugees? Let me just remind you that General Breedlove accused Russia and Assad of weaponizing migration. Well, give me a break. Who made the revolution?
You know the meme of sticking the stick between the bicycle spokes so that you trip over your own bike and then blame somebody else.
That's right. That's exactly right.
And
what
no
it
one
is here.
Asking the question, why did it all happen? Why was the EU behind all of these upheavals, which basically produced the waves of refugees?
Well, liberals don't like to answer questions, Dima. Because if you ask questions, it means you're not on board, and somehow you must be wrong.
Well, okay? Let me just remind people, you know, Angela Merkel is now posing as some kind of humanist, you know, let all the refugees in. She, in 2003, she basically said that Germany should be with the United States when the United States attacked Iraq. Well, she didn't say we should participate in the war. She was not that direct. But the United States attacks another country. The leader of the biggest opposition party in Germany is saying we should be with the United States. What is it if not support for war?
Exactly.
She supported the war in Iraq. She supported the actions in Libya and in Syria. And now she's that benevolent European lady with open borders.
We're rapidly running out of time in our extended version here. Patrick, let me go back to you in Plymouth. For me, it's something that I feel it's necessary to do every week, even if it's in the extended version of the program, is that this benign neglect of what's going on in Yemen. This is catastrophic. It is the worst human rights catastrophe in the world right now. But you wouldn't know that watching
that's
the mainstream
media. That's not rhetoric.
Media.
The UN says it's the worst human rights catastrophe.
Go ahead,
catastrophe
Patrick,
in
because
the
I think
world.
It's absolutely shameful what's going on right here. And everyone is culpable if they don't recognize it. Go ahead.
There's been a delayed reaction with Yemen, and I think the pro-war left in Western Europe and North America, they're a bit slow to the punch on Yemen, but it seems safe now because there's enough distance in the rearview mirror from the Obama administration who launched that, prosecuted this war, who
Good
got
point.
It started in March of 2015. And so now it seemed to be sort of safe, and possibly we could start blaming a bit of this on Trump, perhaps bring in some anti-neocon rhetoric as well, and then sort of attack it from this angle. But, you know, it's too little too late. This should have been pounced on. This is the ultimate violation of, this is an undeclared war of aggression. This is what the UN was founded to prevent,
right,
this very situation. But because there's no evil dictator in Yemen, the liberals couldn't get on board.
It's all a proxy war. It's all a proxy war. Iran is behind it. It's all nonsense.
There is an evil dictator in Yemen, except he was kicked out by the Yemeni people and he's supported by the invasion. Saudi forces.
Right. His name is
Hadi, right?
Mansour Hadi. Yeah.
There's the UN, the Saudi and UAE forces, which are basically ex-Western mercenaries, backed up by Islamist gangs, are attacking the port city of Hodeidah, and this city is the lifeline. Yemen imported 90% of its food before this crisis began. The UN says that 8 million people are at immediate risk of death by starvation. And if this port falls, another 10 million. That's 18 out of 26 million Yemenis face death by starvation. And the Saudi Arabia, backed by and the United Arab Emirates, backed by the US and the UK, quite obviously giving a green light, are threatening to commit an act of genocide in this invasion here. It is a completely unconscionable.
And they block UN resolutions at the Security Council.
Yeah.
Okay. Dima, last word.
Well, I think that basically, I just love this quote from Mr. Kotkin, whose article I quoted today. He said that China's revival could not have occurred without the provision of security by the United States. Well, something is telling me China would have done nicely without the war in Iraq, without the war in Syria, without the war in Libya, now without this whole thing in Yemen. But we keep hearing that the United States is indispensable. And of course, Obama did not make any mistakes in 2015 when he supported basically the attack against Yemen.
Well, Donald Trump believes in that, but in a very, very different way, gentlemen. Okay, that's all the time we have for our extended version of our program. We hope you've enjoyed it. We'll see you next week. And remember, Crosstalk Rules.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.